From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we get advice on what you can do if you witness police violence during an arrest or at a protest. Then we speak to a local photographer about what it's like to capture the ongoing protests in Milwaukee.
These protests truly are peaceful. There's truly no doubt about that. And I march alongside these people with my camera in hand to show everyone that's staring at us and to show the police that we're not afraid to document what happens here.
We hear about how the tourism and hospitality industry is adjusting during the coronavirus pandemic.
The people who were in the hotels in 2019, they were about on average 642 miles away. Right now it's down to about 46 miles. So people that are staying in hotels and staying in Airbnb are driving there. So they're not flying.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. The death of George Floyd at the hands of a Minneapolis police officer has ignited protests around the country. It's also started conversations about the role police officers play in society and the concept of defunding police departments. It was a bystander who took the cell phone video showing Officer Derek Chauvin holding his knee on George Floyd's neck for nearly 9 minutes. As Floyd begged for help and uttered, "I can't breathe," it was bystanders who urged the officers at the scene to intervene. Those three officers have now been charged for not stepping in, and Officer Chauvin was charged with second-degree murder, at least in part due to this video. Now witnesses are capturing incidents of police violence against protesters in Milwaukee and around the country. So what should you do if you encounter police violence at a protest or anywhere else? WUWM's Mayan Silver spoke with Paige Fernandez, the policing policy advisor at the ACLU. She has this advice.
You know, I think most important thing is to keep yourself safe. I think, you know, once you secure your safety, to record if you find an incident like this. You have the right to record the police. You know, there are some states where there are restrictions on the audio, but video images are always allowed. So recording and bearing witness, I think, is incredibly important. And attempting as best as people can to de-escalate the situation, try to get other officers to intervene in what's happening, try to get them to talk to the cop who's engaging in the use of force or the excessive use of force. I think that's really imperative. But I will say that, you know, there is a risk calculation that people have to make, especially depending on their race and how they might be perceived by the police. We know that Black and brown people often bear the brunt of police brutality. So I really encourage people to, you know, make sure they are safe and do that risk calculation for themselves.
So we had an activist here in Milwaukee at the beginning of the protests. He said that he wants legislation in Wisconsin to be able to allow citizen bystanders to step in when they see someone in real danger and not to be charged with obstruction. He said he's not talking about when like an officer is just doing something mild or grabbing your sister and handling your loved one because they're resisting, but when an officer may be bringing someone to the point of death, like in the George Floyd case. Can you talk about some of the possibilities and also difficulties of that type of legislation and if it's even possible or being raised anywhere?
You know, this is the first time I've heard about that. I mean, it's unfortunate, right, that we even have to consider passing that type of legislation to allow civilians to interfere in police activities when the responsibility and the burden should always fall on law enforcement. So, you know, I first want to say that it's deeply troubling that we're at a point where we even have to consider legislation that would allow for civilians to intervene so that cops stop killing people. While I haven't heard of legislation like that introduced, you know, it's an interesting concept. I just worry that it might result in other people being harmed or injured by the police. I'm not sure how receptive police officers would be to a civilian interfering in whatever is taking place, even if that would save the lives of the person who the officer is harming. I worry mostly about the other people who might get involved and then be harmed by the police. You know, I think that the burden of intervening should always 100% fall on fellow officers. You know, they are the least at risk to be harmed by their colleagues. And so while I admire that and I love that people want to step up and get involved, I do think that it really should fall on fellow officers to speak out and speak up against brutality that they witness. It should not be something that is put on civilians who are witnessing an act of brutality.
And clearly, and unfortunately, in this case involving George Floyd, it didn't work. The co-workers, the colleagues did not step in and save George. What would you say about solutions for preventing this type of incident that is multiplied and multiplied beyond George Floyd's case in the future?
Yeah, you know, as you mentioned, this is something that's happened across the country, right? We witness this all the time. On average, there are 3 people who are killed by the police per day, almost about 3 people on average. You know, I encourage people to think broadly, right? I think that we really need to think about policing as an institution and get down to the core of what institutional systemic changes must happen in order for this to stop. So something that I think is really important for people to consider is divesting from police departments and investing in community-based services and resources. I also think it's important for us to think through ways to reduce interactions between police and community members, right? George Floyd, Eric Garner, Philando Castile, these are all Black men who were murdered by the police after they had been targeted for a low-level offense that should not have resulted in their arrest and definitely should not have resulted in their murder. So I think we really need to think about how do we reduce these interactions so that these instances don't take place. And then, of course, we need to think about holding police accountable and thinking about why officers aren't engaging in appropriate behavior. And I think that means setting really strong and ironclad use of force standards. I think it is a requirement of de-escalation for all officers. You know, I am glad to see that the 3 officers who stood by and allowed George Floyd to be murdered at the hands of their colleague have been fired. And that is the direct result of organizers and advocates pushing for police department policies to change that require officers to intervene. Obviously, that did not happen in the circumstance, but they were able to be held accountable because of that policy change that people pushed. So, you know, I think there's a broad range of reforms that we need to be considering, but I really encourage folks to think big picture of how do we make this, how do we ensure this does not happen in the future? And I really think at the core of that is reimagining what public safety means, what policing looks like, and how police interact and how often they interact with community members.
And the city of Milwaukee in particular has had incidents like Seville Smith in Sherman Park and Dontre Hamilton and countless other incidents where Black men have expressed misconduct or bad actions on the part of the police. There was a body cavity search lawsuits, and there was the stop and frisk lawsuit that the ACLU brought in Milwaukee. So I was wondering if you possibly have any particular information when it comes to Milwaukee and Wisconsin in terms of reforms or the way that it's going at this point.
Yeah, you know, I think, as you said, there have been horrible incidents of police brutality that's happened in Milwaukee and Wisconsin at large. I think, you know, Milwaukee is a city where we see incredibly high racial disparities in arrests, particularly as it relates to, you know, low-level offenses, including drug possession. So I think, again, I would encourage the city of Milwaukee and Wisconsin to consider larger, bolder changes in the system. Wisconsin, along with many states across the country, have very weak use of force standards written into their legal statutes, often standards that allow for force to be used not only when it's necessary, but when another officer could consider it reasonable. And so I think that's an important thing for people to consider. But again, I think, you know, how do we limit these interactions? And this is work that can be done through our municipal governments, right? We can push for divesting from police departments and reinvesting in community-based services, including education and healthcare and housing. That's something that can happen on the municipal level through city councils, but also on the state level through appropriations and budget bills.
Well, Paige Fernandez, thanks for coming on Lake Effect and talking about this.
Thank you for having me.
Paige Fernandez is the policing policy advisor for the National ACLU. She spoke with WUWM's Mayan Silver. Coming up next, we speak with a local photographer about what it's been like documenting the protests here in Milwaukee. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Civil rights protesters are continuing to march around the country and here in Milwaukee against police brutality. The way many people are connecting with these demonstrations is through the videos and photographs from people on the ground. Here at WUWM, our reporters have been aided by photographer and videographer Samer Ghani, who's been out at protests nearly every day, working to capture what's been happening in our city. To learn more about his experience out in the field during these marches, he joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski.
Samer Ghani, welcome to Lake Effect.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Before we get into your recent work, I'm curious as to what drew you to photography in the first place as a profession.
Well, I went to a high school called Ronald Wilson Reagan International Baccalaureate High School here in Milwaukee. And they had this very extensive art program for students to graduate high school with art credits moving into to university. And they had a lot of cooperative programs with schools like MIAD and schools like Cardinal Stritch. And I ended up falling in love with art, but I didn't necessarily have the hand for crafting, for painting, things like that. And I ended up renting a school camera, and I kind of fell in love with the idea of documenting what I saw. So after I graduated high school, I went to Cardinal Stritch for almost a year, transferred to UWM, both pursuing photojournalism degrees. And just before, right when I was starting to like complete graduation, like right when I saw it in like my mind's eye, I got hired by Apple, and I worked part-time as a technician and then a lead at Apple, which was great. I learned so many people skills and things about art and technology that I feel like I never would have necessarily had access to if I didn't take that leap. And doing that kind of granted me not only the fiscal opportunity to like buy equipment that that would take me to the next level, but it afforded me the time and space to become like an amateur photographer leading into a professional photographer. So while I was working at Apple, I used that time to document, you know, my friends that were in bands and my friends that were like hip hop artists in the Milwaukee scene. And that kind of just snowballed into where I am today in a nutshell.
Yeah. So your work includes music photography, like you just mentioned, also portraiture, abstract. So how would you say you describe your body of work and how you came to your identity within those mediums of photography?
I think it kind of manifested itself. I definitely have a deep love for like everything, nature and landscape and everything that the world provides to us that is still organic and not artificial. But when I saw all these artists around me, because I love going to shows, I love bands like Paper Holland. Obviously I love Shelly Berry and like Kellen and Sister String. So I would go to these shows pretty avidly anyways, but I realized that these people deserve like professional work. They need to make sure that they're being seen, and shooting landscape photography as like a passion and then shooting artists in Milwaukee as a dedication just started to go hand in hand in those two forms of mediums, where I was like shooting in low light with landscape and shooting in low light at these venues. Those lines just started to blur, and it all just started to become one to me. And I realized that my style just kind of manifested itself as I started doing more and doing more, and like just trying to become a better artist, so to speak, within myself.
So being able to capture and set the scene at shows and portraiture is vastly different compared to throwing yourself out into protests. So what compelled you to get out and capture the protests happening in Milwaukee?
I felt as partially as a community leader and as an artist and as a person of color, it was my responsibility to go out there and document and bring visibility to what was happening. But more so in comparison to a show, the energy is the same, the passion is the same, the people that are there, it's all the same. And since through COVID, I haven't been able to do community work, and I haven't been able to bring positivity to the community like I'm used to. And that's something that I want to do. It's something I really pride myself on doing. So being able to do that now, as terrible as these events that have led up to this have been, I just feel it's my responsibility. It's truly my duty to be out there and bring visibility to who we are and what we're trying to accomplish as a greater community.
And what is that image that you want to share with people, specifically those who don't live in Milwaukee? As outside viewers are looking at protests happening around the country, what is it about Milwaukee that you wanted to capture?
Well, Milwaukee is one of the most segregated cities in the United States. And I think if we're not bringing visibility to these peaceful protests and the message that we're trying to send, then I feel like we're just entirely missing the mark as a community here in Milwaukee. All these people that are in these streets they're all different types of artists. They're all different types of entrepreneurs. There are kids out there, and we're trying to lead a better generation for these kids. And these protests truly are peaceful. There's truly no doubt about that. And I march alongside these people with my camera in hand to show everyone that's staring at us, and to show the police that we're not afraid to document what happens here, because we have no ill intention. We're not the ones who have guns.
And in an age where everyone is out in the protests with their cell phones, everyone has the ability to capture a moment. But what do you think makes a good shot?
In times like these, I think quality. And I think cell phones, the best camera is always going to be the camera that you have on you. But if we can make sure that some of these injustices that are happening at these peaceful protests are documented in high quality, then there's no debate to what's happening or what had happened at that event. There's no UFO quality of what's happening. There's no room for speculation. And I think it's our duty as photographers and videographers to document and bring visibility. It's also our duty to protect the identity of the protesters. And I found myself really struggling on that line. And I've been having a hard time finding what to post and how to keep our community energized moving forward. But I think those lines will start to define themselves as we continue moving forward as a community, as we continue building rules for ourselves that are all inclusive and that are very protecting, not only of ourselves, but people on the other side as well.
Yeah, as you mentioned, there is a growing movement that calls for journalists and citizens to blur or not show protesters' faces. And even though Milwaukee's protests have been peaceful, obviously going in when the protests initially started, as things continue, what are you going to try to do or keep in mind or strategically set up shots? Like, have you decided that you're going to try and have no people's faces on there? And granted, like, a lot of protesters are wearing masks as well. So I'm curious how you feel in that debate, and you're immersing yourself in these protests also.
I've been doing my best to just take pictures of the backs of people's heads and their signs. And the only pictures of faces I've been trying to get are of the protest leaders and our community leaders who are happy and willing to share who they are and what they stand for. I've been sitting on hundreds of photos over the last week from the first 2 days that I haven't posted or anything, because I'm fearful that I may be doing wrong to our community. And I think what these protests have done in comparison to different movements in the past, it's brought people from all walks of life together. And I think people are truly afraid of stepping out of that comfort zone and really trying to fight for something good when they haven't in the past. And any sort of level of comfort that we can bring to people, or any sort of protection that we can bring to these people, I think is most important. So if that means I'm shooting for nothing, that's fine. If that means I'm documenting just for myself until the right thing comes along, I think that's also fine. I think what's important is we're bringing people together and we're making them feel safe.
I know there, like you mentioned, there's hundreds of photographs that you took of protesters moving throughout the city of Milwaukee, but do any specific shots come to mind or stand out to you either because of how they turned out or because of what was happening when you were able to capture that moment?
Yeah, I think on day one, I captured a woman who was being arrested when we protested on the highway just off of North Avenue. And there was another gentleman that I took a photo of, and he had a shirt that just said, "I can't breathe." And there was a crowd of people behind him. And I think those two photos they're of very different people, two very different people from different walks of life. But the unity that they both shared that same day was very important to me. And I think those two photos were very, very, they contrasted each other, but they sent the same message. And I think that was very important.
This is a historical moment, not just because of the protest, but it's also one that's happening in the midst of a pandemic. So when you're out shooting during the protests with masses of people gathering, you know, do you have concerns for your safety either due to COVID or the potential risk that protests like others around the country could potentially turn from being peaceful?
I do fear for my health and I fear for my family's health, but at a certain point, we have to fight for what's right. My fear is maybe the big cats want us to all get sick. And this is just an easy way for us all to get over with COVID as fast as possible. But it's a lingering fear that kind of never goes away. It looms quite like debt does. But, you know, I'm handing out masks and gloves and we're all hand sanitizing as best we can. And like I said, top of mind is keeping us all safe and making sure everyone feels safe and protected. And we're all, I can tell that we're all doing our part, but there is a large cloud of fear, I think, that surrounds all of us when we go to these protests. But what's stronger than our fear is our will to fight for change.
What was your main takeaway being a photographer, not just observing, but being a part of these protests? And what do you want people to feel when they look at your photos?
I think my main takeaway was that no journalist is safe any longer. The lines of how journalists were protected are no longer there, which means that journalists share the same right as the people in the protests do. Like we're all there together. I hope that when people see my photos that they feel inspired to act, whether that's donate money or food, whether that's sharing information, whether that's coming to the protest if they can and they're able. I just hope it energizes the community and it continues to energize the community, because if we have 200 days ahead of us, we all have a lot of work to do. And I just hope to be a part of that flagship to keep people energized, keep people safe, keep people feeling protected, and to keep people fighting for the right cause.
How did this experience impact you the first day you went out, and how do you continue to feel it impacting you as things continue?
I've been stewing on that thought for quite some time. And when I first started documenting the music scene, when I first saw an artist like Kellen Classic, I teared up, I cried because of how emotionally powerful his message was on stage. And when I saw Sista Strings for the first time, I cried because of the message that they were sending through their music and through who they were and what they stood for. And I felt the same about Nickel and Rose. And when I went to that first day of the George Floyd protests, I felt that same impact. I felt that rush of energy in my chest. I felt those tears and I felt that emotion. And I'm trying to hold on to that feeling so that when 10 more days pass and 10 more days pass, that I know that I'm still trying to do the right thing. And it hit me like a ton of bricks in the best way possible.
Well, I know your photos continue to do the same for others looking at them. So, Sam Argani, thank you for your work, and thank you for taking the time to speak with me about it.
Yeah, this has been a dream come true. Thank you.
Sam Argani is a photographer and videographer here in Milwaukee. He joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to talk about his work documenting the protests. You can see more of his work at WUWM.com. Coming up, we'll look at how the tourism industry has been impacted by the coronavirus pandemic. Lake Effect returns in just a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers. Many of us are about 12 weeks into being cooped up at home. That is, if we've followed public health guidelines to limit contact with other people. And even though the state Supreme Court has struck down Safer at Home, our local tourism industry is still feeling the effects of people taking social distancing seriously. Anthony Pennington Cross is a professor of finance and the Bell Chair of Real Estate at Marquette University. He recently spoke with Lake Effect's Julian Haida about how the pandemic has impacted vacation rentals and hotels in the Milwaukee area.
Professor Pennington Cross, thanks so much for joining us on Lake Effect.
Oh, thanks for having me.
First things first, how did the market for Airbnbs and vacation rentals in Milwaukee look before the onset of the coronavirus? What were vacation rentals like last summer, for example?
Right. So one thing to remember with Milwaukee is that we're a little behind a lot of the other larger cities. And so Milwaukee was quickly ramping up in terms of, you know, potential hosts and in terms of renting. And most of the renting occurs through Airbnb, you know, over the summer months. And so, you know, last summer months, it was busy and well occupied, but when you get into winter and stuff, the occupancy rates and the offerings out there are much smaller.
It's not Colorado where vacationing to Milwaukee is something that people might do year round.
Unfortunately, it's very cold here in Milwaukee, and so some people may come for some cultural events to stay a night or two. But, you know, I think it's more the events that we have during the summer do draw in people from all over the country and some across the world. So those are more traditional Airbnb renters. And so that's kind of we have a heavy seasonal cycle here.
I see. And so what that means is going off the winter, heading into spring, which this past year was when the coronavirus pandemic really kind of hit in the United States, they were balancing their books and looking forward to reopening after a lull in the winter. What effect did the virus have on the bottom line of some Airbnb hosts in the city?
Yeah, and unfortunately, this is really tied into the DNC, right? The Democratic convention coming to Milwaukee, and so there was big increases in the number of hosts in the city who are hoping to rent out their condos or their homes. And so this is, you know, been a big hit. If you had someone coming in, they were going to stay in your house for a full week and you were charging a real premium rate, that's likely gone. So, you know, so it's a substantial hit for those folks. There are also Airbnbs that function really in apartment buildings, where a kind of professional host company rents out two or three apartments in an apartment building, and then they rent it out through Airbnb in the secondary market. And so those types of institutions, you know, have been hurt also by this. So it's actually a bit worse for us, the whole COVID piece, because of the Democratic Party convention issues.
So what's the kind of overhead that either a kind of small family kind of renting out their extra room versus a company that is expecting the DNC to come into town, what's the kind of overhead that costs them in expecting to host the people coming into town, and how can those losses be recouped?
Yeah, so unfortunately, I don't know the exact dollars for the overhead, but I could tell you that it's, I know that it's very easy to become an Airbnb host. It's not 100% trivial, but it's almost a trivial thing. And the costs to do that are fairly minimal. So in terms of, from that perspective, the overhead costs are very small. The bigger overhead costs are going to be associated, and where that where risk comes in is if you have a mortgage on a piece of property and you're hoping, you were planning on paying that mortgage through some Airbnb rentals, right, to make it affordable for yourself, or if you're running a company, then, you know, it's going to be hard to make those debt payments going forward. And so we're kind of waiting in the market to see whether that has any additional impact on the performance of those mortgages. So that's where the kind of the overhead comes in, and the obligations associated with the rentals. And so that's important for large companies, and then that's important for families or individuals who were stretching. And one way they were going to make their mortgage payments was through an Airbnb. And then this is also important in a more traditional tourist locations. So let's say if you're renting out a house full time through Airbnb, and it's not your primary residence, and so that could be a financial strain there too.
So there's a difference between having an extra bedroom and an extra set of sheets. Overhead not so high, but if you buy the house next door because you live in a touristy neighborhood, well, then you might be in trouble.
Exactly. Then you're in distress right now.
So do you expect a situation, as we've been hearing a lot about, like mortgage relief because of the economic recession that we're seeing because of coronavirus, do you think there might be a difference if something is seen as an investment property versus someone's primary residence?
Yeah, I would anticipate that there's more forbearance for ownership than there is for kind of pseudo investment property. You know, that said, you know, in the commercial markets, there's a lot of forbearance going on. So just, and typical forbearance, my understanding is that, you know, just kind of extending terms and saying, you know, you don't have to pay me for the next 3 months, but you're going to either pay me back with higher payments in the future, or we're going to extend your mortgage out and allow you to make those payments over a longer period of time. And so hopefully that'll work out, and that should work out okay if the virus gets a situation starts to improve.
That's very interesting. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM 89.7, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Julian Haida, and with me is Anthony Pennington Cross. He's a professor of finance and bell chair of real estate at Marquette University. Now, I've been reading about some renters in more expensive tourist cities like New York and LA, and by renters, I mean apartment renters, people who don't own their homes, who are somewhat relieved that on account of the coronavirus, Airbnb's prices have fallen. They say that it makes it more affordable for them to have a more consistent place to live if the house next door isn't renting out to tourists, they're renting out to people who are looking for long-term residence. How does that track in Milwaukee, or does it not at all?
Yeah, so where that impact, because so there are a lot of potential consequences of Airbnb, and in the kind of, I would call them like mega tourist locations, so you know, the New Yorks and the Barcelonas and places like that, you've had kind of swaths of neighborhoods which were traditional residents, and you know, they've turned into a tourist residence that are short-term renters. So kind of the nature and the feel of those locations have changed. I haven't seen any evidence of that type of that happening in Milwaukee. That said, there is plenty of evidence that Airbnb has driven up rents on a multifamily rental. And so my interpretation of those results are that owners of apartments have, you know, shifted over some of their units to Airbnb, either in-house or through a third party. And so it's reduced the supply of multifamily housing in some locations.
Yeah, that's a very interesting kind of dynamic, a kind of a give and take of where people can live. There's also been a tension not only between homeowners and renters and Airbnb, but also between Airbnb providers and hotels over the years. In part, it's over compliance about laws regarding safety, fair competition. Is this more recent kind of movement around the coronavirus proving that hotels are a little bit more resilient over vacation rentals, given their kind of economic models, or not so much? Are hotels struggling just as much?
Actually, hotels are struggling more. So hotels have proved less resilient to this. And so I'll give you, if it's okay, I'll give you a couple of statistics of what's been going on with hotels. And so if we're looking at luxury chain hotels, the occupancy rate for last week was 14%. The same week a year before, it was 78%. So high-end hotels are largely unoccupied at this point. This isn't as big a deal if you look at the chains that are cheaper, so the economy hotels. And so last week, economy hotels were occupied at about 50%, but their traditional occupancy rate in the prior year was about 63%. So yes, they took a hit in terms of occupancy, but it's not as large on the lower cost end of hotels. So the huge financial strains are on the high end hotels. And what does this have to do with Airbnb? Airbnb is traditionally seen as being a slightly cheaper option. And in general, I was looking up some data about a couple hours ago, and occupancy rates, over the summer, they're projected to be down about 20% from last year.
Airbnbs, so not the kind of dramatic 50, 60% drop as for luxury hotels.
Right. So it's really that top end piece that's been hit really hard in the hotel world.
Why is that? And does it really only just affect their profit margins? Because I think, I'd imagine that high-end hotels and more budget hotels have relatively similar overhead. I mean, sure, the sheets might be nicer. Sure, some of the amenities might be a little bit higher quality. But I can't imagine that making such a big difference. So how are these kind of bigger hotels going to respond? Are we going to be just getting, bargain deals at the Hyatt for the next couple months, or are they going to start shutting down?
There are some large hotels which have pretty much shut down. And so I think for now we're going to be some partial mothballing or the shutting down of some of them. So, these companies are going to be in a lot of stress that are in the high-end market. And so that's just the way it's going to be. Air traffic is way down, right? And so that's kind of an indirect indicator. And so if you look at, the distance people have come to go when they're traveling, when they're going to hotel, I have a piece of data that I got out of Chicago. The people who were in the hotels in 2019, they were about on average 642 miles away, but right now it's down to about 46 miles. So people that are staying in hotels and staying in Airbnb are driving there. So they're not flying. So the kind of the dynamic of those markets have changed substantially.
Yeah. And now, just for sake of context, I'm curious, do you know how luxury hotels fared after the 2008 financial crisis? Was it a similar dynamic, or?
Yeah, it was very similar. So they have a history. When there's a big shock, they do very poorly and then rebound nicely. Once there's more business travel, so business travel is a big portion of that, and once higher income people feeling more confident.
Sure, very interesting. I had no idea that the hotel industry was so volatile, and always great to learn.
Yeah,
thanks
for
so
me,
much.
For me, it's super interesting that you still got 50% occupancy in the cheaper hotels. So I'm not sure exactly who those people are, but I think it's people like nurses and first responders who are not going home or potentially staying in hotels, and these are the people who are being required to go to work. So I think that's partially what's going on there.
Yeah. Well, we'll probably learn a little bit more in the coming months as well. So thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting looking at this market. It's the first time we've seen it, how it's going to perform through a big downturn. So it's an interesting thing to watch.
Anthony Pennington Cross is a professor of finance and the Bell Chair of Real Estate at Marquette University. He spoke with Lake Effect's Julian Haida. We'll take one last break, then learn about one man's experience growing up on Wisconsin's Oneida Indian Reservation in the 1960s. Lake Effect continues in just a moment on 89.7 WUWM. More of Lake Effect Now, I'm Joy Powers. The 1960s was a decade of change in the U.S. The civil rights movement brought intense focus on human rights abuses against minorities, including Native Americans. Today, we're seeing echoes of those same sentiments in protests around the country. As the American Indian movement was occupying Alcatraz, Lewis Clark III was here in Wisconsin, growing up on the Oneida Reservation and dealing with his own abuse. Clark is a member of the Iroquois Confederacy and the Bear Clan, and he faced difficulties growing up as one of just a few Native American children in his Catholic church. He coped with all of it through his poetry. His latest collection is called Rebel Poet. Back in January, we spoke about what it was like growing up on the Oneida Reservation in the 1960s.
When most people think of reservations, they're thinking of like third world country things like in South Dakota, Pine Ridge, South Dakota. The Oneida, where I grew up, we were a reservation, but because of the Indian Allotment Act of, I think it was 1889, and then bringing in settlers in 1912, I believe we only owned like 3 or 4 acres of our 640,000-acre reservation. So when we moved right into the heart of the reservation, which was 1959, 1960, my mom told me that you were supposed to be nice to the Indians. So we had a curb and gutter, and I would sit on the curb and ask people who were walking by if they were Indians because I was going to be nice to them, because nobody actually told any of us that we were Indians. It actually wasn't until I got into grade school where I learned that I was an Indian. I knew my grandparents were Indian, but I didn't think that meant I was an Indian. And then when you start achieving in the arena of the white world, if you achieve too much, someone's always there to put you down and let you know that you're an Indian and you're supposed to learn to stay in your place.
In the book, you talk about growing up in the Catholic Church, specifically going to Catholic schools and being really the only Indian child at these schools. What was that experience like?
Well, it was a great experience going to a Catholic school because the teachers, they wanted you to achieve no matter what. I guess the difference was that you always felt set apart. You always wanted to fit in. But yeah, it was difficult, especially when they came and started teaching about Columbus and how the Jesuits came here to save the heathen savages. Then to find out that you're the heathen savages, that was a striking blow.
You describe your mother as being Haudenosaunee. How do I say this?
Okay, that's the big thing that I'm going through right now because I just moved back to the reservation. They said I have to learn how to pronounce my words correctly because I used to always pronounce it Haudenosaunee, people of the Longhouse. I guess it's supposed to be pronounced Haudenosaunee.
Haudenosaunee.
And that I take with a grain of salt because it was my cousins who were telling me that, and sometimes your cousins always give you a little bit of a rough time. So I'm working on developing my Indian language. I've been away from the reservation for 40 years. We just decided to move back because there's a lot more opportunities for me as a writer as I move back to the reservation.
Yeah, that makes sense. So Haudenosaunee, it's another word. It's the actual word for Iroquois. And when I was looking this up, there's a lot that I didn't know about the term Iroquois. So who are the Haudenosaunee, and where do the Oneida sit inside of that larger term?
We were called the Onigiwa, is the Oneida, people of the Standing Stone. I believe we were on the eastern shores of the Iroquois Confederacy, the land that we occupied. And the Iroquois Confederacy was basically in the beginning five tribes, and it was, can't pronounce his name, Dekauwanida, the peacemaker, came and showed us if you take a bunch of arrows and tie them together, it's very difficult to break, whereas if you take one arrow and break them individually, it's easy to break. So the five tribes, Onondaga, Tuscarora, Seneca, Mohawks, and the Oneidas, all formed together what the English called us when they got there was a confederacy. We were all along the east coast, as far down as Georgia and as far up into Canada, and as far west as Ohio River, I believe. Our Oneida language is a language unto itself, I believe. I don't speak it, but I'm going to start learning it as I move back to the reservation. And I don't think there's too many of us that really speak it completely nowadays. But the wonderful thing is that since 1968, we have been buying back our land, buying back our reservation. We have a school. We're teaching it to our young people in the school. We have a health center. We have very many things going for us. The Oneida people, when they came to Wisconsin and throughout our history, been known as a people who believed in schooling. Five of the first 38 students at Lawrence University in Appleton in 1848 were Oneida students, Oneida tribal members. After being away from Oneida for 40 years, I'm just amazed at the wonderful things that they've done in Oneida, the housing, the taking care of the elders, the health center, just wonderful things that they've done.
You know, as you've mentioned here, you were away for 40 years, and it seemed like, at least in reading your book, that part of that was because of really the difficulties that you faced growing up. Whether it was, yes, feeling a little separate from your classmates, but there was a lot of trouble in your home.
Well, there was a lot of trouble in my home. So when I was growing up, what I encountered seemed normal. It's just the way you made it through life. My dad was in World War II, and he was decorated. He was in 42 battles, and then he was called back to fight in Korea, and that's the only time he ever talked about any fighting. He said he had to run landing barges, and seeing the kids get blown back once he lowered the doors, he said that was the worst thing in his life. And then my mother, in the 1940s, she had dreams. She won an art contest in the 1940s where Mrs. Roosevelt came and gave her the prize. She wanted to go to school. She played baseball like a league of our own. I don't know if she was actually on one of the teams, but she traveled all over the Midwest playing baseball. But then, just like happened to women all over the United States, the men came home from World War II and the women were pushed to the back of the bus. And being an Indian and being a woman was double jeopardy. So she was a cleaning lady, a waitress. Nothing that was fulfilling her, but she went to school continually. And when you're constantly not achieving what you dream of, alcohol overcame our house.
A big way that you've dealt with different issues is through writing. Why did you start writing poetry?
My sister, she had one cassette and a cassette player, and it was Paperback Writer by the Beatles, and I would play it continuously. And then the Monkees came into view. And, of course, thinking we could do anything, two of my friends and I formed a little garage band, and we were terrible, but we had the guts to try. And I realized that once hearing my voice on tape that I didn't think I could sing that well. But I just loved to write and put it together. And then sixth grade, we had a poetry section in school. And I started writing these poems with the repeating words, and I started writing songs, and then people started teasing me and beating me up and that kind of stuff. But it was a release for me, and so I just kept writing continually. I'd write, and in my head I'd write. I'd have stories put away there, and I'd have poetry put away there. When we left the reservation to go to college, I thought I'd take a couple poetry classes. And basically, I was taught that what I write wasn't poetry. At that time, you weren't supposed to write about your soul. And you don't rhyme. And In my head, I heard cadence, not the Indian cadence that they go boom, 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 but just a boom, 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 like their heartbeat. And so I just kept writing, and I wrote in a cadence. I just started writing for me. It was a release because I could write a poem about something that really hurt, and I could throw it away or I could stash it away, and then it was like a cleansing of my soul. I always kept writing, and then I saw an ad in the newspaper send us 5 poems, and they didn't ask for money. So I sent it, and then they called and said, would you send us 5 more? They didn't ask for money, and then they called, and it was a Mr. James Perrins, who happened to be Judge Perrins, the president of the Packers' grandson. And he was the head of the English department at the University of Arkansas at Little Rock. He said, I like your stuff. He says, I like to publish it. I says, well, what's the catch? And he says, there's no catch. He says, you just have to go and start sharing your stuff. He says, what you have, people need to hear. So I did. I just started going on sharing it. And little by little, I went from 20-minute speaking engagements to an hour speaking engagements. Somebody said, why don't you turn your speech into a book? I turned the speech into a book. I sent it down to Arkansas, and the new head of the department said, this has to be published somewhere. It was one of the most unique and creative things he had ever seen. So I sent it to the Wisconsin Historical Society Press. They brought me down there and said, we don't accept manuscripts like this. And so, you know, you're standing there with one tear coming down your cheek wondering, why am I here then? And they go, but what you wrote is different, and we believe it has a social significance. They offered to publish it, and they did, and I guess it's been quite successful. It's helping people understand, and that's what it's about now. I want to share the truths and the hurts that I endured so maybe somebody else will not have to endure it or know somebody else shares that with them. So that's why I publish. I write to cleanse my soul, but I publish to hopefully help other people.
Yeah. Well, Lewis, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Lewis Clark III is the author of Rebel Poet, More Stories from a 21st Century Indian. Clark was raised on Wisconsin's Oneida Indian Reservation, and he's a member of the Iroquois Confederacy and the Bear Clan. We spoke at the beginning of the year. And that is today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for tuning in today. Please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh air is next.